He avoided the subject of Folsom, except to remark that the site wasn't conclusive proof that the Americas were inhabited during the Pleistocene. He won every battle but lost the war, Meltzer said. Every one of the sites that he discredited was, in fact, not from the Pleistocene. He was completely right about them, and he was right to insist that Figgins excavate the Folsom points in front of experts. But Abbott and the rest of the nutcases were right that people came much earlier to the Americas. The Clovis Consensus. Early in 1929, the Smithsonian received a letter from Ridgely Whiteman, a 19-year-old in the village of Clovis, New Mexico, near the state border with Texas. Whiteman had graduated from high school the previous summer and planned to make his living as a carpenter and, he hoped, as an artist. Wandering in the basins south of Clovis, he observed what looked like immense bones protruding from the dry blue-gray clay. Whiteman, who was part Indian, was fascinated by Indian lore and had been following the archaeological excitement in Folsom, 200 miles to the north. He sent a letter to the Smithsonian informing the staff that he, too, had found extinct elephant bones and that someone there should take a look. Surprisingly, the museum responded. Paleontologist Charles Gilmore took the train to Clovis that summer. Clovis is at the southern end of the Llano Estacado, the staked plain. 50,000 square miles of flat, almost featureless sand and scrub. Whiteman's bones were in Blackwater Draw, which during the Pleistocene served as a wide, shallow regional drainage channel, a kind of long, slow-moving lake. As the ice ages ended, Blackwater Draw slowly dried up. The continuous flow of water turned into isolated ponds. Game animals congregated around the water, and hunters followed them there. By the time of Gilmore's visit, Blackwater Draw was an arid, almost vegetation-free jumble of sandy drifts and faces of fractured caliche. In one of archaeology's great missed opportunities, Gilmore walked around the area for an hour, decided that it was of no interest, and took the train back to Washington. The thumbs-down response stupefied Whiteman, who had already turned up dozens of fossils and artifacts there. On and off, he continued his efforts to attract scholarly interest. In the summer of 1932, a local newspaper reporter put him into contact with Edgar B. Howard, a graduate student at the University of Pennsylvania, who had, one of his assistants later wrote, a driving mania to discover a Folsom-like site of his own. Howard had already spent 3 years combing the Southwest for ancient bones, crawling into rattlesnake caves, and taking a pickaxe to rock faces. Intrigued by Whiteman's curios, he asked if he could examine them that winter during his downtime. Howard took them back to Philadelphia, but had no chance to inspect them. A few weeks after his return, a construction project near Clovis unearthed more huge bones. Locals gleefully took them away. One bowling ball-sized mammoth molar ended up as a doorstop. After hearing the news, Howard raced back to see what he could salvage. He telegrammed his supervisors on November 16th. Extensive bone deposit at new site, mostly bison, also horse and mammoth. Some evidence of hearths along edges. We'll tie up permissions for future work. Howard returned to Clovis in the summer of 1933 and systematically surveyed Blackwater Draw, looking for areas in which, like Folsom, human artifacts and extinct species were mixed together. He quickly found several and set to digging. Once again, the telegrams went out. A parade of dignitaries from the east trooped out to inspect the excavations. Howard worked at Clovis for 4 years, each time staffing the field crews with a mix of sunburned locals in boots and jeans, and well-tailored Ivy League college students on vacation. One greenhorn was heard upbraiding his Massachusetts friend for not having perceived at once, as did he, Howard's chief assistant later recalled, that the purpose of a local farmer's windmill was for fanning heat-exhausted cattle. Windmills were not the only surprise in store for the students. The temperature in the digging pits sometimes hit 130 degrees Fahrenheit. Slowly peeling away the geological layers, Howard's workers revealed that Blackwater Draw had hosted not one, but two ancient societies. One had left relics just like those at Folsom. Below the dirt strata with these objects, though, was a layer of quite different artifacts. Bigger, thicker, and not as beautifully made. This second, earlier culture became known as the Clovis culture. Because Clovis was so dry, its stratigraphy, the sequence of geological layers, had not been jumbled up by later water flow, a common archaeological hazard. Because of this unusual clarity, and because Howard meticulously documented his work there, even the most skeptical archaeologists quickly accepted the existence and antiquity of the Clovis culture. To trumpet his findings, Howard arranged for the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia to sponsor an international symposium on early man. More than 400 scientists migrated to Philadelphia from Europe, Asia, Africa, and Australia. The symposium featured a full-scale reproduction, 15 feet wide and 34 feet long, complete with actual artifacts and bones, of a particularly profitable section of Howard's excavation. Whiteman was not invited. He died in Clovis in 2003 at the age of 91. The most prominent speaker in Philadelphia was Aleš Hrdliška, then 68. Hrdliška gave Clovis the ultimate accolade, silence. Before one of the biggest archaeological audiences in history, Hrdliška chose to discuss the skeletal evidence for Indians' early arrival in the Americas. He listed every new find of old bones in the last two decades and scoffed at them all. "So far as human skeletal remains are concerned," he concluded, "there is to this moment no evidence that would justify the assumption of any great, i.e., geological antiquity, for American Indians." Every word Hrdliška said was true, but irrelevant. By focusing on skeletons, he was able to avoid discussing Clovis, the focus of the conference, because Howard had found no skeletons there. Hrdliška's complaint about the lack of skeletal evidence was unfair for another reason. Paleo-Indian skeletons are extremely rare. In Europe, archaeologists have discovered scores of skeletons 10,000 years old or more. By contrast, fewer than a dozen reasonably complete skeletons of similar age have been found in North America. A few more exist in South America, although, as with the Lagoa Santa skeletons, their provenance is often unclear. It's a big mystery why we don't find the burials, the University of Vermont archaeologist James Peterson told me. Some Indians will tell you that their dead all moved to a spiritual plane, and that's about as good as any answer that we've got. Clovis culture had a distinctive set of tools, scrapers, spear straighteners, hatchet-like choppers, crescent moon-shaped objects whose function remains unknown. Its hallmark was the Clovis point, a 4-inch spearhead with a slightly cut-in, concave tail. In silhouette, the points somewhat resembled those goldfish-shaped cocktail crackers. Folsom points, by contrast, are smaller and finer, perhaps 2 inches long and an eighth of an inch thick, and usually have a less prominent tail. Both types have wide, shallow grooves or channels called flutes, cut into the two faces of the head. The user apparently laid the tip of the spear shaft in the flute and twisted hide or sinew repeatedly around the assembly to hold it together. When the point broke, inevitable with stone tools, the head could be loosened and slid forward on the shaft, letting the user chip a new point. A Paleo-Indian innovation, this type of fluting exists only in the Americas. With Blackwater draw as a pattern, scientists knew exactly what to look for. During the next few decades, they discovered more than 80 large Paleo-Indian sites throughout the United States, Mexico, and southern Canada. All of them had either Folsom or Clovis points, which convinced many archaeologists that the Clovis people, the earlier of the two, must have been the original Americans. Nobody really knew how old the Clovis people were, though, because geological strata can't be dated precisely. Figgins surmised that Folsom had been inhabited 15 to 20,000 years ago, which meant that Clovis must be a little before that. More precise dates did not come in until the 1950s, when Willard F. Libby, a chemist at the University of Chicago, invented carbon dating. Libby's research began in the global scientific race during the 1930s and 1940s to understand cosmic rays, the mysterious, ultra-high-velocity subatomic particles that continually rain onto the Earth from outer space. Like so many bullets, the particles slam into air molecules in the upper atmosphere, knocking off fragments that in turn strike other air molecules. Along the way, Libby realized, the cascade of interactions creates a trickle of carbon-14, C14, a mildly radioactive form of carbon that over time disintegrates, decays, as scientists say, into a form of nitrogen. Libby determined that the rate at which cosmic rays create C14 is roughly equal to the rate at which it decays. As a result, a small but steady percentage of the carbon in air, sea, and land consists of C14. Plants take in C14 through photosynthesis. Herbivores take it in from the plants, and carnivores take it in from them. In consequence, every living cell has a consistent low level of C14. They are all very slightly radioactive, a phenomenon that Libby first observed empirically. When people, plants, and animals die, they stop assimilating C14. The C14 already inside their bodies continues to decay, and as a result, the percentage of C14 in the dead steadily drops. The rate of decline is known precisely. Every 5,730 years, half of the C14 atoms in non-living substances become regular carbon atoms. By comparing the C14 level in bones and wooden implements to the normal level in living tissues, Libby reasoned, scientists should be able to determine the age of these objects with unheard-of precision. It was as if every living creature had an invisible radioactive clock in its cells. In 1949, Libby and a collaborator ascertained the C14 level in, among other things, a mummy coffin, a piece of Hittite floor, an Egyptian pharaoh's funerary boat, and the tomb of Snefru of Meidum, the first 4th dynasty pharaoh. Archaeologists already knew their dates of construction, usually from written records. The scientists wanted to compare their estimates to the known dates, even though Libby and his collaborator were still learning how to measure C14. Their estimates were rarely more than a century off. A level of agreement, they wrote dryly, that was seen to be satisfactory. Libby won a well-deserved Nobel Prize in 1960. By that time, carbon dating was already revolutionizing archaeology. You read books and find statements that such and such a society or archaeological site is 20,000 years old, he remarked. We learned rather abruptly that these numbers, these ancient ages, are not known. Archaeologists had been making inferences from limited, indirect data. With radiocarbon, these numbers, these ancient ages, could be known, and with ever-increasing accuracy. One of the first tasks assigned to the new technique was determining the age of the Clovis culture. Much of the work occurred at the University of Arizona in Tucson, which in 1958 established the world's first major archaeological carbon dating laboratory. At the new lab was a doctoral student named C. Vance Haynes. Haynes was a mining engineer who became fascinated by archaeology during a stint in the Air Force. While serving at a base in the Southwest, he began collecting arrowheads, a hobby that ultimately led to his abandoning geology and coming to the University of Arizona as a graduate student in archaeology. As the Clovis culture dates crossed his lab bench, Haynes was struck by their consistency. No matter what the location of a site, carbon dating showed that it was occupied between 13,500 and 12,900 years ago. Here and throughout, I give the currently accepted dates, which are made with better techniques and more grasp of the vagaries of carbon dating than were then available to Haynes. Scientists discovered in the 1960s that the rate of C14 formation and intake varied more than Libby had thought. As a result, raw C14 dates must be corrected, calibrated in the jargon, to obtain calendar dates, something archaeologists do not always make clear. In addition, they often write dates not as years AD or BC, but as years BP before present, with the present set by convention at 1950 AD. Thus, 2000 BP is 50 BC. In an attempt to reduce confusion, all dates in this book are ordinary calendar dates. That is, radiocarbon dates corrected by the most recent calibration. Scientists usually report C14 dates with their potential error, as in 3000 plus or minus 150 BP, 1050 plus or minus 150 BC. To avoid typographical clutter, I do not include the error spread, believing that readers understand the unavoidable uncertainties in measuring minute levels of residual radioactivity. To Haynes, with his geologist's training, the dates were auspicious. The Clovis culture arose just after the only time period in which migration from Siberia seemed to have been possible. During the Ice Ages, so much of the world's water was frozen into glaciers that sea levels fell as much as 400 feet. The strait between Siberia's Chukotsky Peninsula and Alaska's Seward Peninsula is now only 56 miles wide and about 120 feet deep, shallower than many lakes. The decline in sea levels let the two peninsulas join up. What had been a frigid expanse of whale habitat became a flat stretch of countryside more than 1,000 miles wide. Beringia, as this land is called, was surprisingly temperate, sometimes even warmer than it is today. Masses of low flowers covered it every spring. The relative salubriousness of the climate may seem incredible, given that Beringia is on the Arctic Circle and the world was still in the throes of the Ice Ages. But many lines of evidence suggest that it is true. In Siberia and Alaska, for instance, paleoentomologists, scientists who study ancient insects, have discovered in late Pleistocene sediments fossil beetles and weevils of species that live only in places where summer temperatures reach the 50s. Beringia was easily traversable. Western Canada was not, because it was buried beneath two massive conjoined ice sheets, each thousands of feet deep and 2,000 miles long. Even today, crossing a vast, splintered wilderness of ice would be a risky task requiring special vehicles and a big support staff. For whole bands to walk across it with backpacks full of supplies would be effectively impossible. In any case, why would they want to do it? There was a short period, though, when the barrier could be avoided, or at least some scientists so believed. The Ice Ages drew to a close about 15,000 years ago. As the climate warmed, the glaciers slowly melted and sea levels rose. Within 3,000 years, Beringia had again disappeared beneath the waves. In the 1950s, some geologists concluded that between the beginning of the temperature rise and the resubmergence of the land bridge, the inland edges of the two great ice sheets in western Canada shrank, forming a comparatively hospitable pathway between them. This ice-free corridor ran down the Yukon River Valley and along the eastern side of the Canadian Rockies. Even as the Pacific advanced upon Beringia, these geologists said, plant and animal life recolonized the ice-free corridor. And it did so just in time to let Paleo-Indians through. In a crisply argued paper in Science in 1964, Haynes drew attention to the correlation between the birth of an ice-free trans-Canadian corridor and the abrupt appearance of Clovis artifacts some 700 years later. 13,000 to 14,000 years ago, he suggested, a window in time opened. During this interval, and for all practical purposes only during this interval, Paleo-Indians could have crossed Beringia, slipped through the ice-free corridor, and descended into southern Alberta, from where they would have been able to spread throughout North America. The implication was that every Indian society in the hemisphere was descended from Clovis. The people at Blackwater Draw were the ancestral culture of the Americas. Haynes was the first to put together this picture. The reaction, he told me, was pretty gratifying. The fractious archaeological community embraced his ideas with rare unanimity. They rapidly became the standard model for the peopling of the Americas. On the popular level, Haynes's scenario made so much intuitive sense that it rapidly leapt from the pages of science to high school history textbooks, mine among them. 3 years later, in 1967, the picture was augmented with overkill. If time travelers from today were to visit North America in the late Pleistocene, they would see in the forests and plains an impossible bestiary of lumbering mastodon, armored rhinos, great dire wolves, saber-toothed cats, and 10-foot-long glyptodonts like enormous armadillos, beavers the size of armchairs, turtles that weighed almost as much as cars, sloths able to reach tree branches 20 feet high, huge flightless predatory birds like rapacious ostriches. The tally of Pleistocene monsters is long and alluring. At about the time of Clovis, between 13,800 and 11,400 years ago, according to a 2009 study, almost every one of these species vanished. So complete was the disaster that many of today's big American mammals, such as caribou, moose, and brown bear, are immigrants from Asia. The die-off happened amazingly fast. The statistics, according to the study, suggest that it was instantaneous. And when it was complete, naturalist Alfred Russel Wallace wrote, the Americas had become a zoologically impoverished world from which all of the hugest and fiercest and strangest forms had recently disappeared. The extinctions permanently changed American landscapes and American history. Before the Pleistocene, the Americas had three species of horse and at least two camels that might have been ridden. Other mammals could have been domesticated for meat and milk. Had they survived, the consequences would have been huge. Not only would domesticated animals have changed Indian societies, they might have created new zoonotic diseases. Absent the extinctions, the encounter between Europe and the Americas might have been equally deadly for both sides. A world in which both hemispheres experienced catastrophic depopulation. Researchers had previously noted the temporal coincidence between the Paleo-Indians' arrival and the mass extinction, but they didn't believe that small bands of hunters could wreak such ecological havoc. Paul Martin, a paleontologist who is one of Haynes's Arizona colleagues, thought otherwise. Extinction, he claimed, was the nigh inevitable outcome when beasts with no exposure to Homo sapiens suddenly encountered a new and thoroughly superior predator, a hunter who preferred killing and persisted in killing animals as long as they were available. Imagine, Martin said, that an original group of 100 hunters crossed over Beringia and down the ice-free corridor. Historical records show that frontier populations can increase at astonishing rates. In the early 19th century, the annual U.S. birth rate climbed as high as 5%. If the first Paleo-Indians doubled in number every 20 years, a birth rate of 3.4%, the population would hit 10 million in only 340 years. A blink of an eye in geological terms. A million Paleo-Indians, Martin argued, could easily form a wave of hunters that would radiate out from the southern end of the ice-free corridor, turning the continent into an abattoir. Even with conservative assumptions about the rate of Paleo-Indian expansion, the destructive front would reach the Gulf of Mexico in 3 to 5 centuries. Within 1,000 years, it would strike Tierra del Fuego. In the archaeological record, Martin pointed out, this hurricane of slaughter would be visible only as the near simultaneous appearance of Clovis artifacts throughout North America, and the swift extermination of the more conspicuous Native American large mammals, which, in fact, is exactly what one sees. Not everyone was convinced by Martin's model. Paleontologists noted that many non-game species vanished too, which in their view suggests that the extinction wave was more likely due to the abrupt, climatic changes at the end of the Pleistocene. Martin pointed out that previous millennia had experienced equally wild shifts with no extinction spasm. In addition, similar extinctions occurred when human beings first invaded Madagascar, Australia, New Zealand, and the Polynesian Islands. Despite Overkill's failure to enjoy full acceptance, it helped set in stone what became the paradigmatic image of the first Americans. Highly mobile, scattered in small bands, carnivorous to a fault, the Paleo-Indians conjured by archaeologists were, above all, stout-hearted, daring, and voracious big-game hunters. In the skeptical summary of Norman Easton, an anthropologist at Yukon College in Whitehorse, Clovis people were thought to have a special yen for mammoth. Great ambulatory meat lockers. Sometimes they herded the hairy creatures en masse into gullies or entangling bogs, driving the animals to their doom with shouts, dogs, torches, and possibly shamanic incantations. More often, though, hunters stalked individual beasts until they were close enough to throw a spear in the gut. Then you just followed them around for a day or two until they keel over from blood loss or infection, Charles Kay, an ecological archaeologist at Utah State University, told me. It's not what we think of as sporting, but it's very effective and a hell of a lot safer than hand-to-hand combat with a mammoth. Shifting location to follow game, the Clovis people prowled roughly circular territories that could have been 200 miles in diameter. The size would vary depending on the environmental setting. With any luck, the territory would contain flint, jasper, or chalcedony, the raw material for spear points, meat scrapers, and other hunting tools. Bands may have had as many as 50 members, with girls going outside the group to marry. At camp, women and girls made clothes, gathered food, wild plums, blackberries, grapes, and tended babies. Men and boys went hunting, possibly as a group of fathers and sons, probably for days at a time. As the extinctions proceeded, the Clovis people switched from mammoths to the smaller, more numerous bison. The spear points grew smaller, the hunting more systematic, with prey becoming scarcer, it needed to be. Bands camped on ridges overlooking ponds. The men wanted to spot herds when they came to drink. When the animals plunged their muzzles into the water, hunting parties attacked, forcing the startled bison to flee into a dead-end gully. The beast bellowed in confusion and pain as the Paleo-Indians moved in with jabbing spears. Sometimes they slaughtered a dozen or more at once. Each hunter may have gobbled down as much as 10 pounds of bison flesh a day. They came back staggering under the load of meat. Life in this vision of early America was hard, but pleasant. In most ways, archaeologists said, it was not that different from life elsewhere on the planet at the time. Except that it may not have been like that at all. Continental Divide. In the early 1980s, a magazine asked me to report on a long-running legal battle over Pacific Northwest salmon. A coalition of Indian tribes had taken Washington State to court over a treaty it had signed with them in 1854, when the state was still part of the Oregon Territory. In the treaty, the territory promised to respect the Indians' right of taking fish at all usual and accustomed grounds and stations, which the tribes interpreted as guaranteeing them a share of the annual salmon harvests. Washington State said that the treaty did not mean what the Indians claimed, and in any case that circumstances had changed too much for it still to be binding. The courts repeatedly endorsed the Indian view, and the state repeatedly appealed, twice reaching the U.S. Supreme Court. As the Indians approached final victory, tension rose in the fishing industry, then almost entirely controlled by whites. The magazine wanted me to write about the fight. To learn more about the dispute, I visited the delta of the Nisqually River at the southern tip of Puget Sound. Housing the Nisqually tribe, the sliver of land that is their reservation, and the riverbank meadow on which the treaty was signed, The delta is passed through, unnoticed, every day by the thousands of commuters on the interstate highway that slices through the reservation. At the time of my visit, the Nisqually had been annoying state authorities for decades, tenaciously pursuing what they believed to be their right to fish on their ancestral fishing grounds. I met the Franks, the stubborn, charismatic father and son team who then more or less ran the tribe, in a cluttered office that, in my recollection, occupied half of a double-wide trailer. Both had been arrested many times for protest fishing, fishing when the state said they couldn't, and were the guiding spirits behind the litigation. After we spoke, Billy Frank, the son, told me I should visit Medicine Creek, where the Nisqually and 8 other tribes had negotiated the treaty. And he asked someone who was hanging around to give me a tour. That someone introduced himself as Denny. He was slim and stylish with very long black hair that fell unbound over the shoulders of his Levi jacket. Sewn on the back of the jacket was a replica of the American Eagle on the dollar bill. A degree in semiotics was not required to see that I was in the presence of an ironist. He was not a Nisqually, he said, but from another Northwest group. At this remove, I can't recall which. We clambered into an old truck with scraped side panels. As we set off, Denny asked, "Are you an archaeologist?" "Journalist," I told him. "Good," he said, slamming the truck into gear. Because journalists rarely meet with such enthusiasm, I guessed, correctly, that his approval referred to my non-archaeological status. In this way, I learned that archaeologists have aroused the ire of some Native American activists. We drove to a small boat packed with fishing gear that was tied down on the edge of the Nisqually. Denny got the motor running and we puttered downstream, looking for harbor seals, which he said sometimes wandered up the river. Scrubby trees stood out from gravel banks, and beneath them, here and there, were the red flush spawned out bodies of salmon, insects happy around them. Freeway traffic was clearly audible. After half an hour, we turned up a tributary and made land on a muddy bank. 100 yards away was a tall snag, the dead stalk of a Douglas fir, standing over the meadow like a sentinel. The treaty negotiations had been conducted in its shelter. From under its branches, the territorial governor had triumphantly emerged with 2 sheets of paper, which he said bore the X marks of 62 Indian leaders, some of whom actively opposed the treaty and apparently were not at the signing. Throughout our little excursion, Denny talked. He told me that the claw holding the arrows on the back of the $1 bill was copied by Benjamin Franklin from an incident in Haudenosaunee lore. That the army base next door sometimes fired shells over the reservation. That Billy Frank once had been arrested with Marlon Brando. That a story Willie Frank, Billy's father, had told me about his grandparents picking up smallpox-infected blankets on the beach was probably not true, but instead was an example of Willie's fondness for spoofing gullible journalists. That Denny knew a guy who also had an eagle on the back of his jean jacket, but who, unlike Denny, could make the eagle flex its wings by moving his shoulders in a certain way that Denny admired. That most Indians hate the Internal Revenue Service even more than they hate the Bureau of Indian Affairs, because they believe that they paid taxes for all time when the federal government forced them to give up 2 billion acres of land, and that if I really wanted to see a crime against nature, I should visit the Quinault Reservation on the Olympic Peninsula, which had been plundered by loggers in the 1950s. I did a few weeks afterward. Denny was right. He also explained to me why he and some other Indians had it in for archaeologists. The causes were many, in his telling, but 2 of them seemed especially pertinent. Alesh Herdlishka and the overkill hypothesis. Herdlishka's zeal for completeness made him accumulate as many Indian skeletons as possible. Unfortunately, his fascination with the bones of old Indians was not matched by an equivalent interest in the sensibilities of living Native Americans. Both his zeal and his indifference were gaudily on display on Kodiak Island, Alaska, where he exhumed about 1,000 skeletons between 1932 and 1936 at Larson Bay, a village of Aleutic Indians. Many of the dead were 2,000 years old, but some were ripped from recent Aleutic graves and a few were not a lutique at all. The wife of a local salmon cannery manager, eager to help science, shipped her lishka the cadavers of Chinese workers when they died. Larsen Bay was the single most productive excavation of Herdlishka's long career. Confronted with what he viewed as an intellectual treasure trove, this precise, meticulous, formal man was to all appearances overcome by enthusiasm and scholarly greed. In his pop-eyed hurry to pull bones out of the ground, he tore open the site with a bulldozer and didn't bother taking notes, sketching maps, or executing profile drawings. Without documentation, Herdlishka was unable afterward to make head or tail of the houses, storage pits, hearths, and burial wells he uncovered. He pored through old Russian and American accounts of the area to find answers, but he never asked the people in Larsen Bay about their own culture. Perhaps his failure to approach the Aleutic was a good thing. Herdlishka's excavation, made without their permission, so angered them that they were still steaming when Denny was there on a salmon boat 50 years later. In 1991, the Smithsonian gave back the skeletons, which the townspeople reburied. Overkill was part of the same mindset, Denny told me. As the environmental movement gathered steam in the 1960s, he said, white people had discovered that Indians were better stewards of the land. Indigenous peoples were superior to them. Horrors! The Arkies, that was what Denny called archaeologists, had to race in and rescue Caucasian self-esteem, which they did with a ridiculous conceit that the Indians had been the authors of an ecological mega-disaster. Typical, Denny thought. In his view, archaeologists' main function was to make white people feel good about themselves, an opinion that archaeologists have learned, to their cost, is not Denny's alone. Archaeologists are trapped in their own prejudices, Vine Deloria Jr., the Colorado political scientist, told me. The Berkeley geographer Carl Sauer first brought up Overkill in the 1930s, he said. It was immediately knocked down because a lot of shellfish and little mammals also went extinct, and these mythical Pleistocene hitmen wouldn't have wiped them out too. But the supposedly objective scientific establishment likes the picture of Indians as ecological serial killers, too much to let go of it. To Deloria's way of thinking, not only Overkill, but the entire Clovis First theory is a theoretical Rube Goldberg device. There's this perfect moment when the ice-free corridor magically appears just before the land bridge is covered by water, he said. And the Paleo-Indians, who are doing fine in Siberia, suddenly decide to sprint over to Alaska. And then they sprint through the corridor, which just in time for them has been replenished with game. And they keep sprinting so fast that they overrun the hemisphere even faster than the Europeans did. And this even though they didn't have horses, because they were so busy killing them all. He laughed. And these are the same people who say traditional origin tales are improbable. Activist critiques like those from Denny and Deloria have had relatively little impact on mainstream archaeologists and anthropologists. In a sense, they were unnecessary. Scientists themselves have launched such a sustained attack on the primacy of Clovis, the existence of the ice-free corridor, and the plausibility of Overkill that the Clovis consensus has shattered, probably irrecoverably. In 1964, the year Haynes announced the Clovis First model, archaeologist Alex D. Krieger listed 50 sites said to be older than Clovis. By 1988, Haynes and other authorities had shot them all down with such merciless dispatch that victims complained of persecution by the Clovis police. Haynes, the dissenter said, was a new Herdlishka, minus the charge of insensitivity to living Native Americans. As before, archaeologists became gun-shy about arguing that Indians arrived in the Americas before the canonical date. Perhaps as a result, the most persuasive scientific critiques on Clovis initially came from fields that overlapped archaeology, but were mainly outside of it. Linguistics, molecular biology, and geology. From today's vantage, the attack seems to have begun, paradoxically, with the publication in 1986 of a landmark pro-Clovis paper in Current Anthropology by a linguist, a physical anthropologist, and a geneticist. The linguistics section attracted special attention. Students of languages had long puzzled over the extraordinary variety and fragmentation of Indian languages. California alone was the home of as many as 86 tongues, which linguists have classified into between 5 and 15 families. The schemes disagree with one another. No one family was dominant. Across the Americas, Indians spoke some 1,200 separate languages that have been classified into as many as 180 linguistic families. By contrast, all of Europe has just 4 language families: Indo-European, Finno-Ugric, Basque, and Turkic, with a great majority of Europeans speaking an Indo-European tongue. Linguists had long wondered how Indians could have evolved so many languages in the 13,000 years since Clovis, when Europeans had ended up with many fewer in the 40,000 years since the arrival of humans there. In the first part of the 1986 article, Joseph H. Greenberg, a linguist at Stanford, proclaimed that the profusion of idioms was more apparent than real. After 4 decades of comparing Native American vocabularies and grammars, he had concluded that Indian languages belonged to just 3 main linguistic families: Aleut, spoken by northern peoples in a broad band from Alaska to Greenland; Na-Dene, spoken in western Canada and the U.S. southwest; and Amerind, much the biggest family, spoken everywhere else, including all of Central and South America. The 3 linguistic stocks, Greenberg said, represent separate migrations. According to Greenberg's linguistic analysis, Paleo-Indians had crossed over Beringia not once, but thrice. Using glottochronology, he estimated that the ancestors of Aleuts had crossed the strait around 2000 BC, and that the ancestors of Na-Dene had made the journey around 7000 BC. As for Amerind, Greenberg thought, we are dealing with a time period probably greater than 11,000 years. But it was not that much greater, which indicated that the ancestors of Amerind-speaking people came over at just about the time that Clovis showed up in the archaeological record. Clovis first, yes, but Clovis the first of 3. In the same article, Christy G. Turner II, a physical anthropologist at Arizona State, supported the 3 migration scheme with dental evidence. All humans have the same number and type of teeth, but their characteristics, incisor shape, canine size, molar root number, the presence or absence of grooves on tooth faces, differ slightly in ways that are consistent within ethnic groups. In a fantastically painstaking process, Turner measured 28 key crown and root traits in more than 200,000 Indian teeth. He discovered that Indians formed 3 New World dental clusters, corresponding to Greenberg's Aleut, Na-Dene, and Amerind. By comparing tooth variation in Asian populations, Turner estimated the approximate rate at which the secondary characteristics in teeth evolved. Because these factors make no difference to dental function, anthropologists assume that any changes reflect random mutation, which biologists in turn assume occurs at a roughly constant rate. Applying his worldwide rate of dental microevolution to the 3 migrations, Turner came up with roughly similar dates of emigration. Amerinds, he concluded, had split off from Northeast Asian groups about 14,000 years ago, which fit well with the widely held view that the first Americans were the Clovis culture big game hunting Paleo-Indians. The article provoked vigorous reaction, not all of the sort that its authors wished. In hindsight, a hint of what was to come lay in its third section, in which Arizona State geneticist Stephen L. Zagura conceded that the tripartite division of modern Native Americans is still without strong confirmation from molecular biology. To the author's critics, the lack of confirmation had an obvious cause. The whole 3 migrations theory was wrong. Neither their linguistic classification nor their dental genetic correlation is supported, complained Lyle Campbell of the State University of New York at Buffalo. Greenberg's 3-family division, Campbell thought, should be shouted down in order not to confuse non-specialists. The Amerind language family was so enormous, Berkeley linguist Joanna Nichols complained, that the likelihood of being able to prove it actually existed was somewhere between zero and hopeless. Although the three migrations theory was widely attacked, it spurred geneticists to pursue research into Native American origins. The main battleground was mitochondrial DNA, the special DNA with which Pena, the Brazilian geneticist, hoped to find the Batacudo. As I mentioned before, a scientific team led by Douglas Wallace found in 1990 that almost all Indians belong to one of four mitochondrial haplogroups, three of which are common in Asia. Mitochondria with similar genetic characteristics, such as a particular mutation or version of a gene, belong to the same haplogroup. Wallace's discovery initially seemed to confirm the three migrations model. The haplogroups were seen as the legacy of separate waves of migration, with the most common haplogroup corresponding to the Clovis culture. Wallace came up with further data when he began working with James Neal, the geneticist who studied the Yanomami response to measles. In earlier work, Neal had combined data from multiple sources to estimate that two related groups of Central American Indians had split off from each other 8,000 to 10,000 years before. Now, Neal and Wallace scrutinized the two groups' mitochondrial DNA. Over time, it should have accumulated mutations, almost all of them tiny alterations in unused DNA that didn't affect the mitochondria's functions. By counting the number of mutations that appeared in one group and not the other, Neal and Wallace determined the rate at which the two groups' mitochondrial DNA had separately changed in the millennia since their separation. 0.2 to 0.3% every 10,000 years. In 1994, Neal and Wallace sifted through mitochondrial DNA from 18 widely dispersed Indian groups, looking for mutations that had occurred since their common ancestors left Asia. Using their previously calculated rate of genetic change as a standard, they estimated when the original group had migrated to the Americas, 22,414 to 29,545 years ago, Indians had come to the Americas 10,000 years before Clovis. 3 years later, Sandro L. Bonato and Francisco M. Bolzano, two geneticists at the Federal University of Rio Grande do Sul, in the southern Brazilian city of Porto Alegre, analyzed Indian mitochondrial DNA again, and painted a different picture. Wallace and Neal had focused on the three haplogroups that are also common in Asia. Instead, the Brazilians looked at the fourth main haplogroup, haplogroup A is its unimaginative name, which is almost completely absent from Siberia, but found in every Native American population. Because of its rarity in Siberia, the multiple migrations theory had the implicit and very awkward corollary that the tiny minority of people with haplogroup A just happened to be among the small bands that crossed Beringia, not just once, but several times. The two men argued it was more probable that a single migration had left Asia and that some people in haplogroup A were in it. By tallying the accumulated genetic differences in haplogroup A members, Bonato and Bolzano calculated that Indians had left Asia 33,000 to 43,000 years ago, even earlier than estimated by Wallace and Neal. Not only that, the measurements by Bonato and Bolzano suggested that soon after the migrants arrived in Beringia, they split in two. One half set off for Canada and the United States. Meanwhile, the other half remained in Beringia, which was then comparatively hospitable. The Paleo-Indians who went south would not have had a difficult journey, because they arrived a little bit before the peak of the last ice age. Before, that is, the two glacial sheets in Canada merged together. When that ice barrier closed, though, the Indians who stayed in Beringia were stuck there for the duration, almost 20,000 years. Finally, the temperatures rose, and some of them went south, creating a second wave, and then, possibly, a third. In other words, just one group of Paleo-Indians colonized the Americas, but it did so two or three times. As other measurements came in, the confusion only increased. Geneticists disagreed about whether the totality of the data implied one or more migrations, whether the ancestral populations were small, as some measure of mitochondrial DNA diversity suggested, or large, as others indicated. Whether Indians had migrated from Mongolia, the region around Lake Baikal in southern Siberia, or coastal East Asia, even possibly Japan. Everything seemed up for grabs, or anyway, almost everything. In the welter of contradictory data, University of Hawaii geneticist Rebecca L. Kahn reported in 2001, "Only one thing is certain. Scientists may argue about everything else," she said, "but they all believe that the Clovis First archaeological model of a late entry of migrants into North America is unsupported by the bulk of new archaeological and genetic evidence." Coast to coast. The new archaeological evidence to which Kahn referred was from Monte Verde, a boggy Chilean riverbank excavated by Tom Dillehay of the University of Kentucky, Mario Pino of the University of Chile in Valdivia, and a team of students and specialists. They began work in 1977, finished excavation in 1985, and published their final reports in two massive volumes in 1989 and 1997. In the 20 years between the first shovelfuls of dirt and the final errata sheets, the scientists concluded that Paleo-Indians had occupied Monte Verde at least 12,800 years ago. Not only that, they turned up suggestive indications of human habitation more than 32,000 years ago. Monte Verde in southern Chile is 10,000 miles from the Bering Strait. Archaeologists have tended to believe that Paleo-Indians would have needed millennia to walk from the north end of the Americas to the south. If Monte Verde was a minimum of 12,800 years old, Indians must have come to the Americas thousands of years before that. For the most part, archaeologists had lacked the expertise to address the anti-Clovis evidence from genetics and linguistics. But Monte Verde was archaeology. Dillehay had dug up something like a village, complete with tent-like structures made from animal hides, lashed together by poles and twisted reeds, a culture that he said had existed centuries before Clovis, and that may have been more sophisticated. Skepticism was forceful, even rancorous. Arguments lasted for years, with critics charging that Dillehay's evidence was too low quality to accept. "People refused to shake my hand at meetings," Dillehay told me. "It was like I was killing their children." In 1997, a dozen prominent researchers, Haynes among them, flew to Chile to examine the sites and its artifacts. The hope was to settle the long-standing dispute by recreating the Greybeard's visit to Folsom. After inspecting the site itself, a wet, peaty bank strikingly unlike the sere desert home of Folsom and Clovis, the archaeologists ended up at a dimly lighted cantina with the appropriate name of La Caverna. Over a round of beers, an argument erupted, prompted in part by Haynes's persistent skepticism. Dillehay told Haynes his experience with stone tools in Arizona was useless in evaluating wooden implements in Peru, and then stomped outside with a supporter. But despite the heated words, a fragile consensus emerged. The experts wrote an article making public their unanimous conclusion. "Monte Verde is real," Alex W. Barker, now at the Milwaukee Public Museum, told the New York Times. "It's a whole new ball game." Not everyone wanted to play. 2 years later, Stuart J. Fiedel, a consulting archaeologist in Alexandria, Virginia, charged that Dillehay's just-published final Monte Verde report was so poorly executed. "Bungled and loathsome" were among the descriptors he provided when we spoke, that verifying the original location of virtually every compelling, unambiguous artifact on the site was impossible. Stone tools, which many archaeologists regard as the most important artifacts, have no organic carbon and therefore cannot be carbon dated. Researchers must reckon their ages by ascertaining the age of the ground they are found in, which in turn requires meticulously documenting their provenance. Because Dillehay's team had failed to identify properly the location of the stone tools in Monteverde, Fiedel said, their antiquity was up to question. They could have been in a recent sediment layer. Haynes, who had authenticated Monteverde in 1997, announced in 1999 that the site needed further testing. The dispute over the Clovis model kept growing. In the 1990s, geologists laid out data indicating that the ice sheets were bigger and longer lasting than had been thought, and that even when the ice-free corridor existed, it was utterly inhospitable. Worse, archaeologists could find no traces of Paleo-Indians, or the big mammals they supposedly hunted, in the corridor from the right time. Meanwhile, paleontologists learned that about two-thirds of the species that vanished did so a little before Clovis appears in the archaeological record. Finally, Clovis people may not have enjoyed hunting that much. Of the 76 U.S. Paleo-Indian camps surveyed by Meltzer and Donald K. Grayson, an archaeologist at the University of Washington at Seattle, only 14 showed evidence of big game hunting, all of it just two species, mastodon and bison. The overkill hypothesis lives on, the two men sneered, not because of support from archaeologists and paleontologists who are expert in the area, but because it keeps getting repeated by those who are not. Clovis defenders remained as adamant as their critics. Regarding Monteverde, Haynes told me, my comment is, where are the photographs of these artifacts when they were in place? If you're trying to prove that site to other archaeologists, and you find an unequivocal stone artifact in situ in a site that's 12,000 years old, everyone should run over with a camera. It wasn't until after we brought this up that they dug up some photographs, and they were fuzzy. I really became a doubter then. Such putative pre-Clovis sites are background radiation, he said. I'm convinced that 100 years from now, there will still be these pre-Clovis sites, and this will go on ad infinitum. Some of our colleagues seem to have gone seriously wrong, lamented Thomas F. Lynch of Texas A&M, in the Review of Archaeology in 2001. Proudly claiming that he had helped blow the whistle on other Clovis challengers, Lynch described the gathering support for pre-Clovis candidates as a manifestation of political correctness. He predicted that Monteverde would eventually fade away. It didn't. Dillehay's team published more evidence of occupation, including, in 2008, a stone tool with bits of cut seaweed still on the blade. The Pacific coast was then about 55 miles from Monteverde. 3 years later, in March 2011, a research team led by Michael Waters from Texas A&M University announced in Science a remarkable discovery. 15,000 artifacts at a site in central Texas that predated Clovis by more than two millennia. Truly ardent Clovisites, like low counters, are in a definite minority now, according to Michael Crawford, a University of Kansas anthropologist. A conclusion that Fiedel, Haynes, and other skeptics ruefully echo. The Texas site had too little biological material to use radiocarbon dating, so the researchers employed optically stimulated luminescence, OSL. A technique invented in the 1990s that determines the last time minerals were exposed to sunlight. Because OSL is new, it could not have been used on earlier excavations, suggesting, as Waters acknowledged, that many pre-Clovis sites may have been already discovered and mistakenly rejected. The ultimate demise of the Clovis dogma was inevitable, David Hennage, author of Numbers from Nowhere, told me. Archaeologists are always dating something to 5,000 years ago and then saying that this must be the first time it occurred because they haven't found any earlier examples. And then, incredibly, they defend this idea to the death. It's logically indefensible. Clovis first, he said, was a classic example of arguing from silence. Even in archaeology, which isn't exactly rocket science, he chuckled, there's only so long you can get away with it. hugging the shore. Since Holmes and Herdlishka, archaeologists